Especially for the last part, it's time for. We have many leading figures here in this room now, right now, who are visiting us. So that's very nice. Well, as Cliff said, this is an internal colloquium. So I decided to make it very informal. So please interrupt me. And I just decided to talk about some nice story and that I read in some books and so on. So let's see how it goes. So I gave a funny title in the for the colloquium, but maybe I should have called it the story of the fight between. Aristocrats versus democrats, okay? And you will see why this would be a nice appropriate name for this talk. So let's go back in time. To the 40s. With our favorite friend, Heisenberg. Okay? I think it was around 1942 when Heisenberg was worried about how to describe physical processes in terms of only things that you can measure without introducing any extra information or any things that you cannot really measure. So he took as the variables that you can measure, well, that was his choice. He chose to take energy, momentum of the particles, the spin, the mass, and other intrinsic quantities of the particles. And he decided that the main things that we do in physics, or he realized that the main things that we do in physics boil down to three things, which is to measure lifetimes of particles. Okay? That's something we all know about unstable particles, to measure energy levels of systems that absorb particles or emit particles. And finally, this basically encodes all spectroscopy, okay? And finally, to measure cross sections. Okay? So I'm sure you all know very well what these two are. Let me just remind you what cross sections are. Suppose you have a beam of particles going in this direction. There is some set of particles A. They have some density rho A. And we have this distance LA, okay? And it's colliding with a beam of particles going in this direction. This is LB, because we have particles B, density rho B, okay? And then we are interested in knowing what's the number of particles that will come out scattering out of this process. So that number of particles that will come out of this scattering process. We don't consider the ones that just pass through. We just want to measure how many particles scatter. It's clearly proportional to all these quantities. If we call the sectional area A, it's clearly proportional to A, LA, LB, rho A, and rho B, right? Now you would see that the constant of proportionality is something that must have dimensions of area, and that's what we call the cross section. Okay, so that's the quantity that Heisenberg. These three quantities that Heisenberg decided were the important ones that people will use to measure things in physics. Okay, so if any, yes, the density per volume, the number of particles per volume. That's how you can see that the constant of proportionality must have dimensions of air. Okay? Very good. So he wanted to get a unified description of all these three things. So he decided that the way to do it is using a scattering method. Okay? So in classical theory, if you prepare a system where you know that the system can have several initial states, and you're giving a probability that the particle is in a given initial state, and the probability is Wi, you know that the probability of getting the particle in a final state is given by this sum, where these are the conditional probabilities. Okay? In other words, it's the probability of measuring the particle or having the particle in a state F conditioned to the particle being in a state I. Okay? This is in classical theory, but of course our friend Heisenberg knew better than that. And he knew that this whole thing had to be replaced, in particular, our conditional probability had to be replaced by a scattering matrix that is a complex number whose square gives you the conditional probability. So this is our first appearance of complex numbers in our story. Okay? And he also knew that all these probabilities are given in terms of amplitudes that also compute them in this way, and that the relation is not this anymore, but in quantum mechanics, the probability theory is defined in such a way that this is what happens. Okay? So one of the reasons I'm reminding you this is that here in this building, we also consider cases in which perhaps we might want to consider more generalized probabilities. So if we define different kind of probability theories, then we will have different scattering matrices and different S matrices. Very good. Now, so that was in the 40s, okay? So Heisenberg decided that this was an interesting object that we wanted to study, and it depended on those variables, energy, momentum, spin, mass of the internal particles and the external particles as well. Now let's go back now to the future of Heisenberg, okay? So this is a funny trick. We're gonna go back and forward because now we're going to the 50s and 60s. Okay, so what happened there? If you had been a physicist at that time, you would have been faced with a dilemma. The dilemma is the following, that there, at that time, you had experimental evidence of a plethora, that's a nice word. I hope I'm pronouncing it correctly. A plethora of new particles. And these were called hadrons, because they were strongly interacting particles, okay? Now you had all these particles, they were massive, okay? And you were given the problem of describing the physics of all these hadrons, okay? Very good. So you had two choices as a physicist there, or as a theoretical physicist, you had two choices. One of them was to say, well, this plethora of new particles is surely described by some fundamental particles, which are the building blocks that make up all these hadrons, okay? And those were called the aristocrats. The other possibility that you have is to say, no, all these hadrons, each one of them is as fundamental as the other, okay? So you want to treat them in a democratic way. Okay? So I'm sure that everybody would have chosen the democratic way, right? No, I'm not sure about that, because we have to choose whatever experiments tells us to do, right? That's the usual wisdom. Well, at the time, there was absolutely zero evidence for this choice. So a good physicist would have gone for the second one. And so the people, the democratic way is to say that you have to find a physics framework in which all particles are treated equally. Okay.
Well, maybe it would be called communist propaganda.
Pursuing the second option. That's why there's a string dual of QCD, or this way.
Well,
the whole thing started way before that, right? This whole this democratic idea started before that. Yes, but in the end, well, in the end, the string became the aristocrat, and then later on, we understood that the string was not so much the aristocrat. Everybody in the string theory, the brains, and so on, started to become. The whole theory became more more democratic, but that's not the topic of my talk. So let me stick with a. All right, very good. So this was the choice. So let me tell you the postulates that people. So we have to start a theory with something, okay? So let's start the theory with some postulates. So the first one is an interesting one, is to say that all initial and final particles must be irreducible representations of the Poincaré group. So let me remind you what the Poincaré group is. The Poincaré group is nothing but putting together translations. Now, translations here, I mean translations in four dimensions, okay? Not only space translations, but also in time. Translations plus Lorentz transformations. Okay? Now, we might argue, and probably we might argue for hours and perhaps months, whether Poincaré invariance is a fundamental symmetry of nature or is emergent, okay? But let's not try to do that. And remember that we are in the 50s, so probably already saying that you had Poincaré invariance was something great and interesting. And let's keep it as our fundamental postulate and see how far we can go. So as I said, we're going to describe particles using momentum. But now let me talk about the four momentum encoding energy and momentum in a single object. So let me tell you how we can classify particles. So the way we do it is that, say you have a particle with some momentum p. Now, if you compute p squared, okay, this quantity is an invariant of the whole Poincaré group. So it's a good way of classifying particles, and this is called the rest mass. Okay, very good. Now, suppose that you have a particle moving with some momentum p. Yes.
I apologize for this really stupid question, but I never understood the sentence, particles are AirEps of Poincaré group. I mean, a particle is a physical object, and AirEp is a mathematical set. I just don't understand what that sentence means.
No, it means that the objects that your Hilbert space is classified by AirEps of the Poincaré group. You can think about. Yes, that's the definition.
Okay,
very good. So now you have this. This is one of the quantities that are important. Now suppose that your particle is moving with some momentum p, and you are interested in understanding what's the subgroup of the Poincaré group that leaves that momentum invariant. Okay? So that's an interesting concept. Now, the subgroup of the Poincaré group that leaves that momentum invariant is called the Lyrle group. And it turns out to be quite different in the case when m is not 0. It turns out to be SO3, the group we know and love, right? And irreducible representations of SO3 are characterized by S, which is a spin, or what we call the spin. Sorry. Okay? And that's what we call the spin of the particle. For m equals to 0, the Lyrle group contains an SO2 group. And the particles are characterized by something that is called the helicity of the particle, which can be positive or negative half integers. So it's going to be important for us later on. Okay. Particles with positive helicity or negative helicity are different in reps. They don't even have to talk to each other. They can even live in different, you can even build a theory with one kind and not the other one if you wanted to. So that's important. All right. Now, the second postulate is that quantum mechanics is fundamental here, and we have to take it the way it is and not modify it, okay? And that means that these AIs really describe, they must satisfy conservation of probability. In other words, this must be true, which means if you look at the equation or the definition for S, it means that the matrix S must be unitary. So unitarity is the other fundamental postulate that is needed, okay? So I'm going to show, or I'm going to try to argue, that precisely having this continuous Hilbert space, even though it depends on real numbers, right? These are real numbers. And the condition of unitarity naturally leads you to consider analyticity, okay? That's a little bit surprising from this point of view, from what I told you now, but I'll try to argue this. Let me have some preliminary discussion just to prepare the ground for that, okay? So the first one is that if you have your scattering matrix, your S matrix that depends on some momentum of internal particles and some momentum of final particles, one important property of the S matrix is that it must be invariant under translations. Therefore, if you perform a translation, you know that in momentum space, if you perform a translation by a vector A, always going to happen is that you will get a factor of this form, dot A. Invariance tells you that this equation must be satisfied, okay? So this is a statement that the S matrix is invariant under translations. So how can you solve this equation, right? It's a funny equation. You have S is equal to this factor times S. Well, the only way you have to solve this equation is to say that S has support or is proportional to a delta function that sets the momentum sigma, okay? So that's the way this equation can be satisfied. All right, very good. Now, the second thing that we want to do is to say that we are not really interested in S, because S contains a part which is boring, right? Sorry about that. So the part that is boring is the part where the particles don't scatter, right? That's part of the probability that we have to add. And it has a part where the particles scatter and is precisely the transition matrix. And that's the interesting object we want to study. All right. It might be useful to also define or to remove the delta function or to make explicit the delta function from this definition and define something that people call the amplitude. Okay? So that's also an interesting object for us, the amplitude. Okay, so now we're ready. Let's go back to our postulates of unitarity. Okay? So let's look at the unitarity constraint.
Wait, yes. Sets of momentum when you have multiple particles coming in and out.
These are sets of momentum. Yes.
Okay, so then the delta function means the sum of the incoming ones you lose some.
Yes, that's right. Very good, very good. Yep, that's precisely right. Okay, so let's see what happens with unitarity. So let's use this equation into the equation that says that S is a unitary operator. Okay, so what do we get? Well, we simply apply this, and we find an equation of this form. We find that this must be true. Okay, that's the famous equation for the transition matrix. Okay, so let me argue. Something that probably people haven't said in this language. I'm not sure. Probably they haven't. I'm going to try to argue that this object here is what is called in math. It's called a hyperfunction. Well, that's not going to be important. It's just amusing because the name sounds impressive. But yes. Okay. So what is this object? These are two big matrices, right? And these matrices are supposed to encode all the information that happens when you scatter some initial particles and you have all possible internal, all possible reactions that are allowed in your Hilbert space by the selection rules. And you get those particles interacting, producing the final particles in your state. So as I probably didn't say it very well, let me write what I tried to set, let me try to draw it. So this object here is nothing but encoding the information of particles incoming, producing a single particle, say, which is on shell, is a physical particle again, and that particle producing the particles in the final state. So this will be in one of the selections sectors of the whole matrix. We will also have contributions coming from a two-particle exchange. So let me call this J1, one particle, two particles. We also have three particles, and so on. OK? And by these blobs, I mean the following. So if we have T of PI and PF, this is my notation. A blob with in particles I coming in and particles F coming out is T, okay? It's denoting this transition matrix. So the right-hand side of this equation is this sum of processes. So you see that all of them are physical things. They all correspond to transition matrices of all the possible internal particles that you can have in your theory. All right. Very good.
Kinetic states, or you also include bound states, and
here you have. Remember, you have to be democratic, right? Mm-hmm. So everything is included. Yeah, everything. Yes, that's the democratic approach.
Okay. They're on shell things, right?
Yes, these are physical on shell particles. So, very good. So you see here that you're summing over all the internal states that are allowed, right? So here, you have to sum over all the possibilities of this internal particle, and one of the degrees of freedom that you have here is the momentum of this particle, which can be arbitrary because it can be compensated by the momentum of this particle. So that means that you have, in this sum, you have a sum which contains an integral, d for l, and here you have two integrals, because you have two independent momentum. And this is what we usually call here a three-level contribution. We call this a one-loop contribution. And this is a two-loop contribution, and so on. So this is like a perturbation theory. OK? Very good. But it's a funny perturbation theory, because it's not the one that you're used to with Feynman diagrams if you took a QFT course, because these are on-shell particles. Remember, in Feynman diagrams, which I'm not supposed to know because we're in the 50s, right? These are only on-shell particles. Yes?
You said in the 50s, but we knew about Feynman in the 40s. QED was developed with the S-matrix.
Yes, that's true. But yes, yes. Yes, that's definitely true. But remember that here, you are very against quantum field theory, right? That's the state of mind that you want to have now. Yes? Yes.
So we have other physical things that can come out of scattering experiments, things like jets. So how do I think of them in this sort of framework?
Remember, we're dealing with massive particles, only hadrons, right? So you are scattering hadrons, you're producing hadrons, and that's all you see. Okay?
So you can't define anything where before these things hadronize.
Yes, that's right. You're only looking at the thing. So this is the dream of the yes methods, right?
Yeah.
The you have asymptotic states which are very well defined. They don't interact. They do whatever funny thing they do, and then you just measure them at infinity, and that's what you get.
Right.
Right. But the point is that the jets are precisely kind of the thing that.
It's a hint. It is a hint that this picture is not quite correct.
Yes, that's right.
It's a picture that democracy will not win. For communism,
I'd rather go for the second.
Okay. So the punchline here. The important thing is the following. So you see that the fact that this particle is on shell means that in this integral, the phase space must contain a delta function of the form pi squared minus m squared. Okay? I have to restrict the momentum of the of my particle to be on shell. Therefore, by momentum conservation, this integral, this delta function must be there. Okay? So clearly, this piece doesn't always contribute, right? Or usually doesn't contribute because it has support here. So in a theory where you have physical particles which are stable, in fact, this will never be satisfied, right? Because otherwise, this will be a physical particle. So for this thing to give you a contribution, you will have to wander off the region of physical of the physical region, right? So to get a contribution for this term, you have to wander off the physical region. I'll tell you what that means in a second. It basically means that you want to consider, well, let me tell you now. It basically means that you want to consider the momentum of these particles not as being real objects, but you will allow them to be complex. And you can continue the value of, that they have in such a way that this delta function will be satisfied. OK, let me show you something else. Let me show you an equation that looks very much like this one, OK? And it's the following. This is an equation that you all know very well. Take the limit when epsilon goes to 0 of 1 over x minus a plus I epsilon minus 1 over x minus a minus I epsilon. Guess what this is? We all know, right? This is delta of x minus a. Yes, that's crucial. Otherwise, we will get the cross sections incorrectly. Yes, very good. Excellent. Yes. Okay. It's a tough crowd here. Okay, but this equation looks very much like this one, you see? We have these two objects here and this object here. If we could only interpret this piece as being, say, the first one as being a holomorphic function, and the second one as being the continuation of that holomorphic function to, say, the lower half plane, then you will have the difference. And suppose that we're looking at the real line. So you will have the difference of a holomorphic function defined on the upper half plane and a holomorphic function defined on the lower half plane. And that difference is giving you this object here. Well, that's the definition of a hyperfunction. And this is a way to see that the delta function is a hyperfunction. Okay, so you have this difference. But let me not use that fancy name and simply say that what this is telling you is that, or I'm going to call this object here the discontinuity of this function. Okay. Now I want to rewrite my unitarity equation by saying that the discontinuity of my function t is given by my sum of these on-shell terms. Okay?
Now, this also tells me something interesting, you see? The fact that this object is here means that my matrix T should have a pole, okay? So that means that my matrix T should have a pole of the form, okay? And this is how the, what is called the particle pole correspondence came about. Particle pole correspondence. Okay, very good. So you have the particle pole correspondence. So for every particle that can be allowed by analytic continuation, your matrix T should have a pole. Okay, now you might wonder, what are these other contributions here? Well, they turn out to be, or they turn out to correspond to branch cuts in this matrix, in this object T. So these other objects here correspond to branch cuts. To branch cut singularities. All right, very good. So we are now ready to, well, using this pole particle correspondence, let me just mention quickly something that you can derive immediately from here, which is the following. Say that you have your matrix T, okay, your element T. Now you look very close to the region where two of these particles produce two more, but then there is this internal particle going to scatter these other two and produce these other two here, okay? So very near the region where you are probing this pole, the residue of that pole is given by this object here. So in other words, this is the residue at the location of this pole, okay? So very near the location of that pole, the matrix factorizes into these two matrices. But now we can analytically continue parameters so that this particle that is going in this direction, now it looks like, or the process looks like, you had these two particles first coming here, emitting this particle, and joining with these two and producing these other two guys here. Now, as you perform the analytic continuation, this thing that looked like a particle turns out giving you something here that has what we now call the quantum numbers of the antiparticle. This means that this object here, which ends up being the analytic continuation of this object and so on, is supposed to contain the information of the scattering of particles with P and of the same particles with the corresponding antiparticle. So it means that the same object, the same P, is supposed to contain the information of all the scattering of particles and antiparticles. And they all correspond just to analytic continuation. And that is what is called crossing. Okay, this is fantastic. I mean, people have been very excited at that time, I'm sure, to realize that a single object contains information of many processes all at once. You just have to consider a process where you have all your internal particles, or all your particles incoming, and that analytic function reproduces many, many things for you. Okay. So we're ready to make the claim of the analytic S-matrix program. So what's the big claim there? Well, the claim is that the S-matrix, okay, is a function, or our T-matrix, is an analytic function, right? Being an analytic function, it can be determined if you know all the singularities. And the big claim is that all singularities correspond to physical processes. Okay? So just by knowing physical processes, you can reconstruct this object. So that's a big claim. All right. So it's a funny thing to say the big claim, to make the big claim of the analytic S matrix, and then to tell you why the program died. Okay? Well, the program died. I mean, the claim was great and so on. But the program died because of two reasons. The first one is that QFT came along, okay? Asymptotic freedom was discovered. QCD was discovered as the correct theory of strong interactions, okay? And well, experimental evidence for this was very strong in this, okay? In the 70s and so on. So that was enough to kill this as a theory of strong interactions. But there was also something important here that contributed to the problem, to the death of this, is that the whole approach of reconstructing the S matrix from its singularity was a very hard mathematical problem. And people were stuck and they didn't know what to do. Okay? Yes?
Yeah, maybe John will know better, but I think it was Borkheim scaling about everything. I mean, later that he was at entire freedom and so forth, but the evidence that they really work hard comes.
Yes.
Was the beginning of the test.
Very good. Yes.
In the 1970s, weak interactions became a big thing.
Yes. Right. Yes, and in 82, if we see the, we saw the Z and the W, so.
It wasn't obvious at all that field theory would be the way to go, because up to that time, any field theory would be closed, did not satisfy.
Yes,
satisfy.
Yeah.
The fact that the quantum field theory was maybe the insight.
Right. So one of my points here is that it would be, it's interesting to look at the history and see how people were thinking. So let me just tell you a nice story very quickly. But maybe should. No, I don't have time to do this.
I should want one more comment historical. So I did through this. In the 60s, Giovanni de Chiara was part of the physics. You had to do a religious matrix too. It sounds familiar. History repeats itself sometimes.
Yes, yes. In fact, they say somewhere that even if things are wrong and so on, I'm sure that the techniques here and so on will find a place in the future. That's written in somewhere. But let me just mention very quickly something else. Back in the 60s, when our friends here were thinking that massive particles were the most important thing in nature and that actually electromagnetism was an accident of nature, right? It's annoying to have photons. It's who order photons anyhow, right? And photons must be there only so that there is macroscopic matter so we can measure it. So, and then we can build the S matrix program. So that was the logic. But also in the 60s, more precisely in 1967. Somebody else was thinking in a completely opposite direction, was thinking that maybe massless particles were fundamental, and that was Penrose. Actually, he was in love with analytic functions, he was in love with complex numbers and so on, and he was very disappointed that in 3.1 signature, you have three space dimensions and one time. How can you make something that has complex numbers in it? It's crazy, right? It tells you that definitely this idea of complex numbers has nothing to do with anything. But he also knew that if you stand here and you look at the null rays that you can see, okay, that cross you, say you look at the path, that forms what is called the celestial sphere. And of course, every good mathematician knows that a sphere has a nice is a Riemann surface, so it has a nice complex structure in it. And then he said, well, what happens if I perform a Lorentz transformation, right? Now it turns out that that's the main breakthrough. If you perform a Lorentz transformation, the complex structure of the sphere is preserved.
So thinking about the celestial sphere as a complex object, as a complex manifold, was meaningful. That's a BlackBerry, I guess. Oh, sorry, I have to go. Okay, so complex functions came along if you were considering null rays. So he came up with this idea that maybe null rays are the fundamental object to describe physics. And he decided to build the space of null rays. So how do you do that? You take a point, and you dot it with Pauli matrices. You make a four vector of Pauli matrices. I cannot believe this. OK, you make a matrix of this form. And then you say, well, I introduce two vectors, OK? Now, two vectors. These are just objects with two components, OK? And I ask myself, what are the solutions of this equation? Then you find that the solutions of these equations of this equation for a given point is basically some point AA dot of reference times something of this form. And this object here, if you take the difference, this is a null vector. So this pair, lambda W, is something that describes all the null rays crossing a given point in space-time. And he called this pair a twister. OK, well, twister theory was developed. He thought it was a reformulation of a space-time where fundamental objects were twisters describing null rays. So you were supposed to think about all the physics you know, everything, in terms of twister space. So there was some twister space. He found that, for his disappointment, that the space of null rays is actually five-dimensional, so you're back again to the same problem. Shoot, you have an odd-dimensional thing. Well, the way you fix that problem is that you consider complexifying Minkowski space. Now the twister space becomes six-dimensional and becomes a nice complex manifold. It's CP3. Nicer than that cannot be. And inside CP3, you find something that is called PN, which is five-dimensional, and that represents, each point here represents the motion of a spinless particle. And he found quite nicely that points here and point here represent the motion of particles with a spin, with positive frequency or negative frequency. So he was completely sure that he got the theory of the universe. And all he had to do was to tell us how to describe interactions, right? Well, he started by looking at the free field equations and found that quite nicely you can solve them by considering contour integrals in this big space of holomorphic functions. So you choose your favorite holomorphic function of these variables, and you build for and they build for you nicely a solution of the free field equations. Now all he had to do is to put them together and build objects that will have the properties of amplitudes. So in the 70s, he introduced something that are called twister diagrams. OK? And that is a way, say, if you have the amplitude of particles 1, 2, 3, and 4, and that was supposed to be a way of encoding the information of the external particles together with some contours. And this thing was supposed to give you your amplitude, OK? Don't worry, you are not. This is completely on purpose. You're not supposed to understand what this is. In fact, nobody understood what they were for 30 years. So the reason is that coming out with these contours, each block here represents a copy of CP3. So you have four CP3s, and you're supposed to build a contour where a certain form can be integrated and give you something that has the properties of an amplitude. I mean, that actually, I would say the reason why this didn't fly is that actually this one is even harder than that problem. Very hard math again. Okay. So this was tough luck. He was also trying to reproduce Feynman diagrams. And he found that these objects didn't quite came together as Feynman diagrams. Okay. So these twister diagrams were these crazy objects, which nobody understood how to define, which didn't quite have the properties of Feynman diagrams. OK, so let's leave it there. And let's go back. Now we really want to go back to the future. Our time.
Part of the whole S matrix program was going into the angular momentum plane.
Yes.
And developing what was called regiform thing.
Yes.
And this played a very important role in the whole thing.
That's very good. Yes.
Yes. It also plays a role in so called string theory.
The so-called string theory, yes. Yes. But what I'm going to start, the first thing that I want to say is that, well, nowadays we know that we have the standard model and gravity. And the standard model at high energies, we all know that we really have to think about massless particles, OK? So that's what I want to think about now, massless particles. Now let's try to think if we could repeat, or we could try the, say we were somebody who worked on the S, on the analytic S-matrix program, and looks at this data and says, look, I just followed the data. Now we have to consider massless particles. Seriously, let's repeat the program with massless particles. OK, very good. So the first thing that you will try is to start with a three-particle amplitude. OK, so you have your scattering matrix of 1, 2, and 3. Momentum conservation tells you that p1 plus p2 plus p3 must be 0. OK, now all particles are incoming because we now know crossing, so we're free to do this. OK, and all particles are on the mass shell, which in this case means that pi squared is equal to 0. Now you can see that if you put p1 on the other side and you square, what do you find? If you put p1 on the other side and you square, you find 0 on that side. But here you find p2.p3. Now you can put p3 on the other side and square, and you find p1.p2 equals to 0. And you find p1.p3 equals to 0 as well, very easily. Therefore, this object doesn't have any kinematical invariants, non-zero, that can depend on. So clearly, it must be 0. Well, that's kind of disappointing, because you had expected that maybe three-particle amplitudes would be somehow fundamental. But there is something interesting here. These equations, if you look at them for four vectors, right? We know what they are, right? You take each of the components of these ones, you multiply them, and then you add the other components and so on. So this is a quadratic equation, right? There is nothing special to this. Now, it turns out that if you use Pauli matrices to rewrite these equations, you find that quite nicely they factor. That's a very non-trivial property. So they factor into two objects. One, well, this is a real equation, so it must factor into two objects. Let me call one of them Z23, and the other one is a complex conjugate, Z23 bar. Well, you would say that this doesn't do anything for us because, OK, so here this one factors into Z12 bar, and Z13 bar equals to 0. Now, this doesn't buy us anything because if Z12 is equal to 0, its complex conjugate is also 0. So we still don't have any kinematical invariants. But that's because we are using momenta that are real. But we know that if we want to study our particles, the poles, If we want to explore the pole structure, remember that we said that they were not in the physical region. So why do you want to consider momenta that are real? You have to analytically continue that momentum to explore those poles, right? Now, if you do that, you have to consider the momenta of the particle to be complex objects. Once they are complex objects, you can replace this by saying that you have Z12 times something that is completely independent. Let's call it W12 bar equal to 0. And now you see that all of a sudden, you find that there are solutions to these equations where not everything is 0. So you can build three particle amplitudes that are non-zero. So you have your three particle amplitudes. And they can be a function of the z's or a function of the w's. Now, somehow, your three particle amplitudes have decomposed into a holomorphic function plus an anti-holomorphic function. And we know that when you have holomorphic functions, there is a lot of power that you can use, right? You can use all the power of complex analysis.
Pretty good.
So, and you also know that if you go to the physical region, these functions must be zero, okay? Now, it turns out that when you go to the physical region, where all the z's go to zero, or all the w's go to zero, either f or g go to infinity in that limit, and the other goes to zero. That's what happens. So it means that one of them is not physical for a given three particle amplitude, and the other one is a physical one. Therefore, by looking at the behavior of this function on the physical region, you can choose one or the other one, depending on the helicity of the particles. That's why I wanted to stress the helicity of the particles. So say you have particles with helicities plus minus s. These ones have minus helicity, minus s, these ones plus s. In that case, it turns out that this function is the only one that survives because this one blows up and you have to set it to zero. Its coupling constant to zero, and you find something of this form. And that's the answer, times a coupling constant. Let me call it. Any suggestions for a coupling constant? Well, I already used G here. Okay, fine. That's too bad that I used G there. Okay, fine. Excellent. So we have this. And now we can use the fact that we know that scattering amplitudes are supposed to have poles and so on, right? Yeah.
Historically, before this SVX theory got underway, the big thing was dispersion relations.
Yes.
The kernel Kronig dispersion ratio from the early 50s and 40s
yes.
was for photons in the complex p-plane.
Yes. Yes.
So the death of all this democracy was not due to lack of understanding of massive particles.
No, in the case of the massive particles, in general, the whole problem of trying to understand all these French cat structures became extremely complicated. And I mean, you can read in all the books as they say, look, we need much more progress, but this thing is really complicated, and we don't see how to go further.
Everything is too complicated.
Perhaps. Okay. So let me continue for a second, and then
we can go back to that point. Okay. So in order to explore these poles that we know are there, right, in the unphysical region, what we're going to do is to take the momentum of two particles and go to a frame where the two particles are back to back. Remember that these are massless particles. So their momentum must be null. So we can go to a frame where they are back to back. And what I'm going to do, in order to explore these poles that are not on the physical, on the physical region, is to deform these particles, these momenta, by adding a complex vector, still preserving momentum conservation. That's why I have to add, I have to subtract here whatever I add here. And I still want these particles to be on shell, because they are now complex, but still everything must be on shell. So the only choice I can make, or almost the only choice I can make, is Q to be this complex vector. Now, if I do that, my amplitude, which I'm now considering, say, the four-particle amplitude, becomes a function of this complex variable. And it turns out that if you study the analytic behavior of this function as a function of z, it's just a single complex parameter, right? In the z plane, at zero is a function that you want, and you know that on the unphysical region, you have all these poles we talk about. It turns out that now you can construct this using just these poles, okay? Now, you would say, also in the 60s, people were saying, well, that's a dispersion relation, but then you have to worry about the behavior at infinity and subtractions and so on, okay? That's something that people worried about. The way to do that here is just to study this object. You study this dispersion relation, like integral, around a contour here around zero. You deform this contour, and then you explore all the poles which are in the unphysical region, okay? But you also explore the contribution at infinity. Now, here is an important point. If you were considering massless particles, if you were considering particles without a spin, just to make life simpler, you would find that there is a contribution at infinity. Now, it turns out that for particles with a spin, say one and spin two, you find that there is no contribution at infinity, and therefore you can build your amplitude just by using the residues we computed before. Remember what they were? They were these objects times the poles that you have. But these objects are A's as well, and therefore you find a recursion relation that computes for you all the scattering amplitudes for any number of particles. All the computation boils down to the computation of the free particle amplitudes, which were completely determined by Poincaré invariants. So that means that in the case of spin 1 and spin 2 particles, the whole S matrix, the whole three-level S matrix, is completely determined in terms of what? In terms of Poincaré invariants and physical singularities. You don't have to use anything else. You don't have to invoke gauge invariants, diffeomorphism invariants. Know that this is gravity and this is Young-Mills. Okay? So just using this simple idea, you are able to realize the program or the S-matrix program for these theories. So somehow they would have gotten very, very far if they had done, if they had considered these theories instead of the theories they were considering. So my idea is that one of the reasons they didn't go very far is that they were applying their techniques to very, very difficult theories. While if they had done these theories, they would have succeeded in doing something very nice. Okay? So this is one of my conclusions. Okay? So the S-matrix program is realizable. Okay? At this moment, at tree level, is realizable precisely in the way they wanted.
Really making the claim, I mean, just in case, just to make sure that the claim is as strong as it is, the claim is then that all the tree level perturbative amplitudes in general to be determined by those principles.
Yes.
And the same thing for the
And the same thing for the In fact, if you study this, the spin one case, just looking at getting a four particle amplitude that has the correct factorization channels, you will discover that the coupling constants of the three particle amplitudes must be first anti-symmetric, and second satisfy a weird identity. And that weird identity, if you didn't know what it was, it would have been very strange to you. But it so happens to be Jacobi's identity. So Lie groups emerge from Poincaré invariants. Yes?
There's one other principle. I mean, that has to do with the behavior at infinity, which you need to tell you that there aren't higher dimension operators present in the tree level.
Actually, for these two theories, that's not even necessary. These two theories, you can prove that there is no contribution at infinity without even knowing a Lagrangian. Yes, so that's something recent, actually.
But so you can also mesh now.
I don't want to go off the mesh shell. I think the whole idea is.
Wait, that's telling you that if you have. It sounds like you're saying that even if you have an R to the 4 or R to the 6 term in your tree level Lagrangian, that all tree level amplitudes will be unaffected.
You're asking unitarity. It's unitarity.
Yeah.
So he's saying that such theory will not be unitary.
Okay, let me give my second conclusion and then we can go to the
question. The conclusion is
the idea. Okay.
Or
it doesn't contribute
on shell. Or not sure. That's
a redefinition.
Okay, so let me just give my second conclusion, and then we can ask questions. Right. The second conclusion is the following. You see, I started the whole thing by saying that this thing looked like a perturbation theory, right? Now I'm telling you that at tree level, you can actually build things out of these things, and you can ask, what's the connection with Feynman diagrams? The answer is I have no idea. This thing looks like a very different thing, a very different way of doing perturbation theory. Okay? Now, have you heard those words before in this talk? There is no connection with Feynman diagrams, nothing simple that you can see how to connect it with Feynman diagrams, right? So if you had come out with this and you didn't know how to prove that these were amplitudes, you would have abandoned this idea, right? Well, if you understood all this convoluted thing that I was saying or trying to say, probably you will guess what the second conclusion is. The second conclusion is that if you take this new expansion, okay, which doesn't look like Feynman diagrams, it's very different from Feynman diagrams, and you see what this thing looks like in twister space, well, you guessed it correctly. These are twister diagrams. And the reason why Penrose couldn't connect them to Feynman diagrams is that they are not connected to Feynman diagrams. They came from a different source, completely different source. Now, the way unitarity and everything builds in this object actually encodes the information of these crazy contours. Okay, so let me just give you an example. Precisely for the four particle amplitude that I drew before, now we know that it must be built out of three particle amplitudes. So a three particle amplitude ends up being something like this. Another three particle amplitude ends up being something like this. You see, when you draw it in paper, what's black and white gets. This is the major complication in this theory, to be able to translate from the paper. Now it's not the hard mathematics, because yes, I want to translate from one thing. Shit, I got it incorrectly again. Yes, okay, let's start again. I'll tell you next time.
If I can get it right, I'll tell you. Okay, I think I need two of these. And I need two of these. Right? So these are three particle amplitudes in this language. And the way this thing is telling you to connect them, okay? These are the ones that you are deforming, and they turn out to be connected in a way. And the internal ones are connected by three lines. And the lines are encoding the information about the contours, okay? In a, it's not, well, it's, it wouldn't, I wouldn't be able to tell you in 10 seconds how to do it, but the whole idea is that this recursion relation in twistor space gives you a way of building the twistor diagrams that Penrose was looking for, or that he tried to construct. Okay, thank you.
I'm still just a little bit confused about this. For S equals 1, I mean, we know that there are higher derivative operators in two-gauge theory. The theory is still unitary at tree level, and it does change the S matrix. So where are you inputting the absence of those operators here?
No, it must be thought of the other way around. You have this thing, right? These three particle amplitudes, you put them together to build a four particle amplitude that satisfies all the requirements. You go on, you build the S matrix, now you look for the theory, for the effective, for the theory that gives you that S matrix. And you will find there is a theory without those terms. It's the other way around.
Sorry, but the theory that has the extra terms doesn't, it's either equivalent or it doesn't have an S matrix. So so there's no tree level S matrix for a theory with higher order operators.
That statement isn't true. If you add it, you had an E dot B quantity squared term to the Lagrangian gauge theory.
Yeah.
That's unitary. Because it only has two time derivatives, it does change the S matrix, the 4-point function, but it doesn't change the 3-point function, the trio level. So you must be inputting.
No, the 3-point functions that I told you about are two all orders in perturbation theory. They are valid to all orders in perturbation theory.
Yes, nobody's arguing with that.
So no, you said at 3 level, they don't change. The 3 particle amplitudes at 3 level.
So the point is the 4-point function is not universal, even in unitary theory.
Yes.
So how does your theory know
that? There's only one other source of three particle amplitudes, and these are three, right. So here I'm assuming that the only three particle amplitudes with non-zero couplings are the ones of the form. But in your theory, there are
four.
This was announced here.
Not at tree level.
He's not looking at three levels.
This is true to all orders in perturbation theory. The form that I'm telling you, holomorphic, tells you that there cannot be anything else in perturbation theory that modifies the function that I
wasn't question about four-point function.
The point is that there's a term you can add that preserves unitarity, doesn't affect the three-point function, and it does affect four and higher-point functions. So how can these recursion relations be true without extra information?
Well, the point is that it's not described in that order.
But you're saying that the recursion relations hold just based on unitarity.
No, yes, that's true. So they build for you the theory with only F squared term. Right. The other ones will generate vertices. So very well, I mean, you write down any kind of vertices that you want, and if you have to add them by hand at some point, you will modify the perturbation theory. That's certainly true. So I don't see the contradiction. This inner perturbation theory that you build out of these things,
yes,
is what it is. And you try to find out what the Lagrangian is that produces that, and you will find that it's an F squared Lagrangian. That's it. Now you add something else, right? Then you will generate, say, quartic interactions that are fundamental now from your point of view of the Lagrangian. Mm-hmm. Right? They are not built here. They would be a different perturbation theory. You see what I'm trying to say?
Yeah. Other questions?
The tree graph theory is classic. Tree graph theory is classical.
Okay.
I'm sure in the 70s, I mean, you sum up tree graphs, and if you expand GR around the flat space time,
yes,
you sum up the tree graphs, you just get the Schwarzschild solution for it, just by standard calculation. So we know that gives the right answer, supposedly. Also, the fun begins with loop graphs.
Yes.
That's where quantum physics comes in.
Yes.
And that's when gravity becomes non-normalizable, da 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 da.
Yes.
So,
well, that's
how do I anticipate that all of this is going to work to give me a finite quantum gravity theory that's finite to all orders?
Yes.
Unitary to all orders, Gaussian rate to all time.
Yes. So that takes me to something else, which is that if you want to extend this to loop, at loop level, you find out that, once again, this complicated structure of singularities, you are hunted again by the same things that happened there in the 60s. However, there is a very special theory that has a large amount of supersymmetries for which all these complicated networks of branch cuts and complicated things can be determined in terms of a very simple set of singularities, which are of the highest possible codimension. And those are called living singularities. And those are very easy to compute. And that theory is n equals a supergravity. So at one loop, it has been proven that the whole one loop S matrix is computed in terms of these living singularities now. So the conjecture is that maybe it can be possible to define the whole S matrix in terms of these living singularities. Now, something that is not a conjecture, which is just a true statement, is that if that were possible, then the theory would be finite. But
nobody's proven that.
Nobody has proven that.
Also, if we don't find a supersymmetric particle, what would be the future of that theory? It all depends on the experiment in the end.
Well, very much what the future is now, because the theory doesn't have a chiral matter. So.
That's a okay. Last question.
Yeah. Has anybody thought about whether the whole program could be carried out with Kappa Planck ray symmetry?
With Kappa
Planck ray symmetry.
I think back in many people like Simone, Bianca, and everybody can find to think about it. Yes.
So we thank Freddie again.